Ricky Lynn Lewis is a prisoner. If Texas has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison workers are preparing to execute Lewis by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, where more than a third of all U.S. executions are carried out. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, and Mike Gillespie. Houston Vigil reporter outside the death house, Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Deloitte Parker, co-founder and executive director of Houston's Shape Center for over 40 years. The execution watch for Ricky Lynn Lewis begins.
And we also have with us Jack Lee tonight, so we've got a full stable full of lawyers here that's going to do this. Let me get Gloria back. Gloria, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Now, has anything happened while we've been doing the billboard?
Yeah. The news media went in, and now the Ricky's friends are going in, and I'm going to give just a little shout to them.
Okay.
Message. So Renee and Danielle, we love you. We thank you for being there for Ricky. And we know this is probably the most difficult thing you've ever done, but be strong and say goodbye.
Thank you for that, Gloria, because those folks need the reinforcement. Now, let me explain to the audience what is the significance of Ricky being adopted by these folks. In Texas, bodies are property. And when someone gets executed, who has the right to secure that body for burial outside of Texas prison system is the next of kin. Usually the issue is resolved from a wedding by proxy between some person on the outside and somebody on death row, so that that person can claim the body and bury it elsewhere other than in the inmate indigent cemetery. In this case, Ricky was adopted. Those folks will own the body when the process is through today and do with it what they choose.
And they're going to go to the church when the execution is over, and they'll be able to touch the body
while it is still warm. Actually, we have pictures of that on the website. Did you supply that of Sarge?
Yeah, I took that.
That was
after I asked his son.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Sarge is wonderful, and the whole family is wonderful. I had to went through quite a struggle. By the way, the video of Execution Watch program where Sarge was also interviewed on video is still running on Houston Media Source.
Oh.
Yeah, you have to call over there and get scheduled because they're scheduled somewhat erratic. But Sarge's execution is still up and running.
I'm standing next to a French journalist who knows the couple that adopted Ricky, and he's in tears. He's a real journalist, but he said, you know, we don't execute people. He said, this is so unbelievable that it's even happening to me. I've been a reporter all over the world, and this is the hardest thing I've ever been at.
Lori, we appreciate your work. You'll be back in touch with us if anything else breaks, right?
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Again, I'm Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch. We got a little multi-thumbed early before all of this began, and our other reporter, Dave Atwood, is apparently not answering his cell phone, so we can't get a report. But there is a demonstration going on in Houston. I think this week it's going to be at St. Anne's Church down at Westheimer and Shepherd. And those folks are being vigilant with signs. Every time there's an execution, there are actually demonstrations all over the state. We've covered them in Brownsville and San Antonio, El Paso, and in Houston most frequently. We're going to try to get David on, but maybe he has his cell phone on stun. So it's time to get into this case, Ricky Lynn Lewis. Jim, what we got?
Well, this is a case of very old. Back in 1990, three men broke into a house in East Texas. And it's a little town called Tyler, which is in deep East Texas, right outside of Dallas. And three men broke in after dark, and the people that lived at the house was a gentleman by the name of George Ray Newman. And he's engaged to a gal by the name of Connie Hilton. And what happened, Connie Hilton was getting up and going to the bathroom, and she saw some of the men go by the bathroom. She screamed and heard a gunshot. She didn't see what happened. She just heard a gunshot. And then the men came in and subdued her. Turned out later that they had shot and killed George Newman. George Ray Newman's 45-year-old man. Shot him in the face and killed him. Then after they killed him, they ransacked the house, took her outside, brought her back in. Then they raped her. And it, apparently only one of the group did the raping. And then they escaped, Lee taking her car, and on the way out, either coming in or going out, they also killed the family dog. So what you basically have is a murder committed during the course of a burglary. You have a sexual assault that was committed at the same time. And then about 3 days later, Ricky is arrested. Ricky Lewis is arrested. And what's really interesting about this case is that none of the other men involved with it were never named, were never mentioned, were never apprehended, were never found. And there's no guarantee. No one knows, for example, whether who did the shooting. But they were able to tie Ricky Lewis to the crime scene through DNA evidence on blood and well as semen. DNA evidence tied him to the sexual assault. Plus, they had DNA evidence connecting him to the car that was stolen. And basically, the whole case is based upon forensic science. And that's how that he was caught. Well, he wasn't caught by that. He was turned in by a couple of drug dealers. That's how they connect him to the crime scene. But we still don't know with any assurance who, in fact, actually did the shooting.
Do you know for a fact whether or not Tyler has its own forensic science department? Is that likely handled by the DPS?
DPS did all of this. This is all DPS. Did all the work on this case.
And do we know if there were two other people or three other
people? Well, Ricky claims there were four people involved. The Connie Hilton, the gal who survived, identified that she said she heard three different voices and was able to describe two of the assailants and heard three different voices. So from her testimony, there were three people involved, one of whom was Ricky. And then from Ricky later claimed there were four people involved, but again, nobody knows for certain.
Did she see any of them well enough to be able to identify them, or did she identify them by those voices?
She gave a description to the police initially, but she was unable at trial to identify anybody. Because what happened is kind of, I don't know if he's called it interesting or not, but he was convicted the first time and given the death penalty, and that was reversed for an error committed at punishment. So they retried the punishment issue again, and she again testified. And basically, there were two trials, and she never identified anybody at the two trials. All she was able to do was talk about voices, three voices, and she gave a physical description of two of the assailants and heard some of the words they said. That was basically it.
Did you get to see enough of the transcript to know how that trial went?
Here's a problem. See, this case happened in 1990, and then the first trial happened in 94, and that was a number of years ago. And none of these cases were published. By that, I mean that they weren't published in any books or published in any opinion. So it's almost impossible to find an opinion that's that old. The only written opinion I was able to find was one of the Fifth Circuit on later writs, but it had very little information about what happened transpired at trial. But basically, from what I gather from the Fifth Circuit, it was a evidence case based primarily on forensic evidence, period.
Forensic evidence, and so there's, if this same situation happened today under the same availability of witnessing, would this be complicated?
Probably not. East Texas, it probably would be.
Tyler.
Because see, the problem you got is real simple, and you can't evade the fact, deep East Texas, you've got a black man who's been in and out of the pen most of his life, committing a murder, then sexually assaulting or being a part of a sexually assaulting
a lady.
Ricky had
a significant record.
Yeah. And then, see, they also add to the fact that they sexually assaulted the girlfriend after killing her fiancé in the same house. And that's pretty damaging evidence for a Tyler jury.
As far as anyone knows, they had no previous connection with the victims in this case.
None I could ever find.
Okay. Okay.
Now, Susan was going to discuss all the prior stuff. She'll tell you about what happened
all the way prior. Let's see what kind of record Ricky had.
Okay. Ricky had a number of prior convictions, but the reason I think two juries voted to give him the death penalty, I don't think it was actually the number in terms of the number being a large number. I think what it really was is some of the cases certainly had an element of what you would call gratuitous violence and aggression towards a person who was already a target of a crime such as burglary or theft or robbery. One case I think that was, it would be under the category of extraneous bad acts, was an aggravated robbery and kidnapping that had occurred before the case he's being executed on. And apparently he went to a retail store. The idea was to commit a robbery. He held up the store. He obtained some cash from the store. But he held an elderly woman who was a clerk hostage, took her outside, and took her around, I guess, to the side of the building where it was secluded, had her face the building. He was raising his hand with the gun, so she thought he was going to kill her. And apparently a car came by, and that caused him to not kill her and flee.
What was all this evidence presented by people that really happened to in court?
Yes, yes. See, that woman, that victim of that crime, she testified and she said she believed she was about to be killed. So, of course, that would be very, you know, he could have robbed the store and left. There's an element of just gratuitous for no reason, you know, aggression against the person who's already a victim. Also, there was a previous case where apparently he was burglarizing a vehicle. An 18-year-old girl came upon the scene. I guess it was her family's vehicle, and he assaulted the girl. And kind of, once again, he could have fled. Okay, there wasn't really any reason to assault her. So, you know, I think it wasn't really the number of thefts and robberies. He did have cases where he stole the refrigerator. He had a case where he stole the truck and fled, and then the police caught up with him. He got combative with the police. But I think really what it was in some of these cases, there was an element of, you know, gratuitous
violence. Yeah. Yeah.
And he killed the dog.
And of course, if you're the district attorney, you would want to present as much of that evidence as possible.
Well, sure,
in order
sure.
to influence the jury for the most part.
And the case he's convicted on, the rape of the woman did not, shall we say, further the crime of robbery. And, of course, killing the dog.
Of course, the other voice in this interview is Susan Ashley, and Susan Ashley is an experienced criminal defense lawyer. Could you have blocked any of that evidence if you had been representing this client?
I don't think you could have. I don't think you could have. The state is entitled to put on previous convictions at punishment and extraneous bad acts.
Could you have gotten behind the curtain and negotiated and said, wait a minute, there's only so much horror this jury needs to be exposed to?
I think the state is going to put on, they'd be entitled to put on the evidence, and that evidence would come on. And I don't think you can ever underestimate how much people love dogs.
Susan, I've worked with lawyers in cases where they had like crispy babies that were burned mm-hmm. to death. And those lawyers were able to get in there and negotiate down the number of photographs that are exposed to that jury. Now, Jim Skelton's going to get back in because Jim Skelton has dealt with crispy baby cases.
Well, what I was going to tell you is the issue in death penalties are different because, see, one of the questions, will a person be a future danger?
Uh-huh.
That's different than a regular punishment hearing.
Ah.
So when they have an issue of future dangerousness, any act that indicates he'd be a danger in the future is going to come in. So remember, in a death penalty case, it's unlike a crispy baby case, we're not seeking the death penalty. Because then you're a little bit more limited in what you can do. But since you have the issue of future dangerousness, all this stuff comes in.
In the crispy baby case I'm familiar with, it was criminal negligence, which is not a capital case.
Right. And so when you don't have a capital case, and in this case, though, when you talk about future dangerousness, this opens the door for any sort of bad act that a person might have done. Of course, they got to have the proof. If it's not a conviction, they got to call the victim that was a product of that bad act. So the future dangerous issue is what opens the door for all of this evidence.
One of the really good things about Execution Watch is that we have a a bevy. I guess lawyers can be pluralized in bevies. We have a bevy of qualified lawyers that actually face prosecutors and juries every day. And Larry, you've got something to say about this case? Is there something in there for you? Here is Larry Douglas, who is also another criminal defense lawyer.
Just a couple of things, Ray. But even on the Crispy Baby case, the photographs, I mean, you can only admit so many. So the getting behind the scenes and going to the judge and seeing how many of these, because at some point it gets to be overkill. So that limitation is not that they're not going to come in, it's just how many of them they're going to be admitted. But as to this case, there are a couple of things, and that is the evidence of mental retardation and the expert witnesses. Now experts can testify as to the ultimate, give their opinions.
Sure.
As to the ultimate issues in the case. Okay. And their opinions themselves and the inferences from their opinions can be used. Now, in his case, in the Lewis case, at the time he was tried, Atkins and Briseño had not been handed down.
Okay.
So the mental retardation issues were done at the writ hearings. And so what happened there was that evidence of retardation, as required under Atkins, and then laid out the specifics, sub-average intellectual capacity, mental capacity.
Yeah.
Limited adaptive abilities and also onset at an early age. Those three factors were decided at the writ, stage of the appeals, but that was decided solely by the judge based on the, competition between actually four experts, the state's experts, and the defense experts.
And the judge just put more credibility in one or other, and he has the power to do that, right?
The judge has the authority to do that and to decide, I'm going to believe one group of experts or place more weight on one group of experts and not on the other group of experts. And that's exactly what he did.
The judge solely is the trier of the value of that evidence.
And on appeal, the appeals court is pretty much bound by what the judge determined because it is the judge's in his sole discretion. So the threshold question, that is the amount of the IQ number, sub average IQ, the base is about 70. His IQ was tested somewhere between 59 and 79, where the state saying it was more like the 59. And the defense saying, no, the 59 was not an accurate.
You mean the state saying 79 and they're saying 59.
The state saying.
The high one.
The high one, correct.
Yeah.
And the defense saying the low one.
Yeah.
And saying further that not only is it low, what the state is claiming is simply not supportable. That was it, but it was left up to the judge to decide, and based on the judge's decision, which had to be agreed to by the appeals court, the judges decided, well, the state's experts were more credible, or at least more believable, and decided that, well, since his IQ was not sub average, we don't really need to get into a whole lot of details about what the other factor, the limited adaptive skills and the onset at an early age. But Briseño, but some of that stuff would have been provided in terms of how did he do in school, the people, his family members who knew him, to determine whether he seemed to be acted retarded at an early age and
sure.
Those kinds of
but
factors.
But you didn't get there because the judge bought the big number.
They're sort of all interrelated, but in the final analysis, the judge's decisions, based on what we've seen, seems to have been more determined by that IQ number. And as we know, that's not necessarily a solid number. It's not like measuring somebody's height or their temperature or anything of that sort.
Sure.
It's based on their opinion. But because they're experts, they can give their opinions, and the
the person deciding can decide the ultimate issue.
Well, if resting all of that on solely on this judge in Harris County courthouse term, is that kind of like taking punishment to the bench in Ted Poe's court? You might have a snake up there.
Well, I don't like to get personal about even a former judge.
Oh, I do.
But
then I'm not an officer of the court.
But
no, Ted would tell you, don't bring punishment to this bench.
But it's a decision. Those kinds of decisions should be made between the lawyer and the client. That probably wouldn't be a good if you have a punishment issue that you can submit to 12 people rather than one, no matter who those 12 people are, who that one person is, it's typically better to go with the 12.
I need to remind the audience that wonderful voice belongs to Larry Douglas, who's a regular lawyer here on Execution Watch. And he's a thoughtful fellow. He's careful with talking about Ted Poeck, and I just learned. But there are other aspects about him that has even more charm than that. But this sounds like the last one of these we did, where the judge made a man of questionable IQ stand up and waive his rights to having at least one other lawyer in the mix through three levels of appeal. So, I don't think that this defendant would have been able to assist the lawyer in making the decision of to rest this in the hands of a single judge.
And while there might be some similarities between this case and in the prior case, that I don't remember all of the facts of that case, but I do remember those being a lot worse, in my opinion.
Well, that was onerous.
That was terrible.
It was onerous.
In this case, he did get a shot at due process.
Yeah.
And he provided the expert testimony. It just was not successful.
Now, the cases that determine the standard of these circumstances kicked in after his trial.
Exactly.
So that knowledge was not available to the lawyer at the time he tried this case.
That was not the law at the time he tried the case.
And so the appellate lawyers were playing catch up.
They were playing catch up, but in any event, he did get a successive writ to be filed, and the issue was at least considered. So he at least had a shot at it. Going to the judge might not have been the best shot.
It was
a shot.
There's several opinions around that, but I want to bring in Barrister Lee. I know we've got waiting in the wings is Deloitte Parker, and Deloitte, I'm glad to have you listening to some of this. You don't have to comment at all about this case, Deloitte, when it becomes your turn. Jack, what's going on?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about what Ricky Lewis was claiming in terms of the other people. One of the things that they actually had a pathologist that said that the angle of, I thought this was real strange, the angle of the bullet that struck Mr. Newman, the man that was shot dead, they had a pathologist come and testify that Ricky Lewis, being 5'3", couldn't have been the shooter because the shooter, or at least that was the inference, that the shooter had to be 5'10" in order to, with the assumption that the shooter was standing straight up and Mr. Newman was also standing straight up, because there was something like less than a five degree angle of where the bullet penetrated. And I think this is, it's just so speculative that I'm not really sure.
There's a lot of different factors that could happen.
Sure. I mean, the victim could have been lying down, in which case it really, there's no, that would completely throw things off. Mr. Newman, the victim, could have been sitting, he could have been standing, he could have been lying down. Ricky Lewis could have been standing on a step stool. I mean, there's so much variability here that I think it's much, much too speculative to have really been been seriously considered. I think ultimately what Ricky Lewis was trying to do was perhaps to throw some doubt upon the idea that he was the shooter, and suggest that, well, I didn't shoot him, that there were two other people and possibly a third person. And it begs the question, why weren't these people identified?
Jack, I appreciate this contribution, but I'm still back at 59 to 79
mm-hmm.
IQ. How complicated can this guy think?
Well,
and what you suggest is a strategy. It's the lawyer's strategy. It's not Ricky's strategy.
Yes, this is completely accurate. However, we are talking about Tyler, Texas, and we are talking about a black man shooting and killing a white man, then raping his fiance, then shooting his dog. I mean, local juries juries are important, and you're just the kinds of this kind of a crime is.
Do we know who handled this case?
In all the opinions I read, there never was a complaint really that the lawyers were ineffective, because really the major thing.
No,
was,
I mean there's some great.
No, I don't.
Texas
the only thing lawyer. I have noticed, like, who did the trial work, and no, Mike Charlton did all the writ work, is where the big issue on insanity came in. And see, Ray, here's the problem you got. Theoretically, you can say he had a shot. That really is not true. Because here you have the one that heard the writ is an elected judge.
Yeah.
He's elected by the people in East Texas.
In that county.
He has standing before him a man who had been in and out of the pen 5 times over a 7-year period.
Yeah.
He had a man that broke into another man's house, was either a part of or did the shooting himself, shot and killed a white man, then sexually assaulted the white man's fiance in the very house where the body still laid of the dead man, then shot a dog. You think he's going to ever give a fair shot to that guy? That's a joke. He's got to be elected with those people again. He's going to keep his job. He's not going to give this guy a fair shot. So when you have one psychiatrist from the defense side saying 59 IQ, the state side saying, no, it's 79 IQ, guess who's going to go?
Absolutely.
That doesn't take a genius to figure that out.
Okay.
And he's going to go with it.
I just lost. I was speaking to go to D. Lloyd Parker. I just lost him. Elizabeth, if you can hear this, find D. Lloyd again. And get him back up, because this seemed to be an opportune time to bring in Deloitte. Deloitte Parker, who is the executive director over at Shape Community Center, was part of the coalition that worked in addition to the prison show. And Judon Boney, before Judon went to city council, on the Clarence Brantley case. Clarence Brantley, we discovered on the prison show, the evidence in that case was destroyed in an East Texas courtroom, this time being Montgomery County as opposed to in Tyler, Texas. And the judge and the prosecutor went through the evidence box and found evidence that was in conflict with their intended convicted person, Deloitte, convicted person Clarence. And they took it out and went in the bathroom in the judge's office and flushed it down the toilet. Well, that's kind of the political motivation that Jim was talking about there, because what happens in a courtroom in that case, just like what happens in a courtroom in this case, has a lot of political implications in later trials for the people involved. Ultimately, they did not destroy the source of the information. Okay, here we go. And Deloitte, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Ray.
I was just pointing out to the listening audience, tracked you down, about the Clarence Brantley case. And you and I both worked on that significantly. And that was a case where the evidence, as presented to the court and the jury, clearly indicated that Clarence was the guilty party, but the jury did not know that the judge and the prosecutor had destroyed that evidence.
Yeah, that all those involved in all the players that eliminated, destroyed all the information that would not only clear Clarence, but that would eventually convict the murderer and the rapist.
Ultimately, that justice was done in that case, but it was after Clarence Brantley was released from death row.
Yep.
Okay, with that in your mind, here we've got a case today, and you don't have to know anything about the case. We got a black man, we got a white victim, we got an East Texas judge and jury. What do you expect from that?
I don't expect justice. I got to go by what I've seen over the past 10 years. I pretty much expect them to, in terms of the final level? I mean, Ray, you know the answer to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just trying to wrest it out of you because you and I both know that there are thousands of people, not all of them on death row, but there are thousands of people who are placed in situations where there is a predetermined bent to the direction that justice is going to go, and the evidence can easily be manipulated in this case. In this case.
Not only is the evidence manipulated, but you have inadequate counsel. I mean, when you have somebody going to sleep doing a trial, and he's supposed to be representing you, and your life is at stake. I mean, I'm thinking about the Gary Graham case.
Yeah.
I mean, the lawyer literally went to sleep on the trial. I don't mean a figure of speech going to sleep. I'm talking about literally going to sleep. And so you have a combination of factors that contribute to that are not in the best interest of the party, you know, because it's just nauseating to think about it. You know, I don't expect this. We have a serious problem with this system, man, and you know it.
Well, what bothers me about the particular case that we've been talking about tonight is there are three or four people involved, depending on whose number you're going with, and two or three of them were never identified.
That's right. But why do you think, you interviewing me. Let me ask you.
Yeah.
Why do you think? It continues on that level. Why do you think that? Why do you think, knowing what you and I know, and if you know it, and if I know it, you know damn well they know it. Why does it continue to be as it is relative to what's going? We know what's going to happen. What they want to happen. I'm just kind of frustrated, man.
Well, I know it's frustrating. Dealer, I'll get up in a cop's face in Houston, Texas. You think I'm going to do that in Cornrow? And you and I are activists, you know. I mean, there is a standard of conduct. I mean, because if I get a cop's face in Houston, I probably know the judge is going to hear the case. Mm-hmm. And I've got lawyers that I can rely on to sue whenever I prove that what they did was bullcrap.
Right.
But I can't do that in Conroe.
No, you can't do that in Conroe. Or you can't do that in Jasper. You can't do that. You know, a whole lot of little cities you can't do that in. And I guess what concerns me is that the movement, we have a movement, you know, to abolish the death penalty.
Clarence Brantley is alive because we have a movement.
That's right. Well, that's the only reason he's alive. Now, I mean, a lot of people might look at the legal counsel and all that, but, you know, the people kept the movement alive. The people kept the case alive. People gave the attorneys and others something to fight with. Because I say all the time, there ain't no power like the power of the masses, you know, when the people speak out.
And what impresses me about your institution, Shape Center, and the elders and the people there, is Clarence Brantley is still their friend. They still rally around him. And D. Lloyd, that's been a long time.
Oh, yeah, man. It's been I thought about the times, Ray, when we had buses leaving Shape on our way to Galveston. He got his evidentiary hearing, you know.
Yeah.
Thought about when we had to go to Dallas when those two police officers were on trial for killing Ida Delaney.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know who the judge was then. It was Ted Poe.
Yeah.
And had we not packed that courthouse, had we not stayed and witnessed at what we call court watch, those officers they probably wouldn't have gotten the slap on the hand that they eventually got. That's all they got was a slap on the hand because the law prohibited them from getting anything else under those conditions. We left at 6 o'clock in the morning on our way to Dallas, at 5 o'clock on our way to Dallas to trial, to pack the courthouse. I'm telling you, whatever we do, I think about what Gloria and Jerry and what you and what all of us are doing and the part that we all play in this movement. It's a collective effort. Each of us bring what we can bring to the table, and each of us do the best that we can do with what we have. And we're fighting against a system that has a whole lot more economically, whole lot more in terms of materials and in terms of resources than we have, but yet we holding them at bay, man. We fighting.
Well, the picket line is the ultimate. I mean, I come from, my parents were labor goons, so I come from picket line. Belief, you know, right? I mean, and you come from civil rights background, and you folks were in the struggle for generations before it was your turn.
That's right.
And so the best we can do is hold up. We ain't going to win even most of them.
Oh, we're not going to win, but you know what? One victory is a victory for the masses, a victory for the people.
And you've got a sign out at the side of the road where young men and women, many falsely or excessively accused, come to you for shelter, and that door is always open.
Always, and we always have been, and we always will be, because we understand that, I mean, to be convicted, condemned, be kicked, stumped on, spat on, and then after that happens, then they come to us for us to do the same thing that the system has done to them. We can't let that happen. So these doors will always be open for those who've been victimized by the system, those who are potentially be victimized by the system. The doors will always be open for that. You ask Gloria, you ask Solomon. The Shape Center is a people's institution, and we will always be there for the people, because it ain't no power like the power of the masses, and we gonna prevail, man. We not gonna give up.
Deloitte people are listening to the show all over the world. How do they find Shape Center and Deloitte Parker on the internet?
Well, all they have to do is look for shape.org, shape.org. And if they want to email me, look for shape at shape.org. So the website is shape.org.
shape.org.
That's correct. The email is shape at shape.org. And we're located in Houston, Texas. That address is 3903 Alameda, or 3815 Live Oak. Zip is 77004. And be here 6 days, and most of the time 7 days a week. And from as early as 7:30 in the morning until 7 plus at night, especially when they have the death penalty abolition movement meetings, and when they have other meetings, and we house the Association of Black Social Workers, the death penalty abolition movement. We house a lot of progressive movements at SHAPE. And we'll continue to do that. So if they want to talk, call, write, email, they got all the information there, and we'd be glad to share whatever it is that we can share with them.
Thank you, Deloitte, for your friendship and your vigilance.
Love you, brother. Stay strong.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay.
That was Deloitte Parker, and Deloitte Parker is the founder and the executive director of Shape Center, which is a community institution here in Houston serving it's not fair to say the black community. The door's open. Anyone seeking support in a struggle toward justice will find friends there. All right, Jim, where are we?
Okay, I'm going to make something clear here. The way this works on writ hearings, and the people don't understand writ law too well, obviously, why? What happens after somebody's been convicted and then you lose it, what we call on direct appeal? In this case, truthfully, I don't care if you'd have hired Clarence Darrow from the dead and Christ in heaven would have come down. If you tried this case in East Texas and Tyler, they're going to give him the death penalty. I mean, I don't care. You could have 20 lawyers, they're still going to give him the death penalty. And that was a foregone conclusion. Because the only issue is the people are really impressed with scientific evidence, and all the scientific evidence pointed toward him being a party of it. So then you add that to it, and the people are impressed with scientists. And then you add to the fact that the question, would he be a future danger? Has the guy been in and out of the pen 5 times in 7 years? Obviously, they're going to say you're a future danger. The real, what I call guts of this case, would be the writ hearing. Now, the way that works, after somebody's been convicted, you go back into the court where the conviction took place, and you file what we call 1107 writ. And you're entitled to an evidentiary hearing, but you're not entitled to a hearing in front of a jury. You are stuck with whatever judge is a district court judge in that case. 99% of the time, the district court judge who hears the writ is the very same judge who heard the initial trial. So you know by the fact that in this case, the 24 different people, 2 different juries, gave him the death penalty. a judge from the county where he, that those 24 people vote, is going to be the one going to hear the case. The likelihood of him trumping what 24 voters have said is extremely remote. I mean, that's just simply not going to happen. And the way it works is that the lawyers can put on a ton of evidence, and they put on a whole bunch of evidence being able to demonstrate the man had a 59 IQ. The state turns around, and one of the real problems that's real frustrating with lawyers, because Larry Douglas and I were talking about that, and Larry was an insurance adjuster. He had an insurance man told him, I'll get an expert to say an arm will grow back if I need an expert, sure. So you can hire any expert you want. So you have one group of experts for the defense saying the guy's got an IQ of 59. You have experts for the defense, for the state saying he's got a 79. Now, guess who that judge is going to believe? The judge has to make findings of facts, conclusions of law. And you know good and well as I do, that's a foregone conclusion. The judge is going to side with the state because he's not going to go back and face an electric after 24 people gave him the death sentence.
Sure.
It's not going to happen. Now, here's what happens. Once that judge makes that fact finding, the way the appellate system works is real simple, and it's kind of naive in a real genuine sense. What the appellate courts say, we are bound. We're bound to follow the factual finding of the judge so long as it is supported by the evidence. Well, here, you got one group saying 59, one group 79. That's supported by the evidence.
Either way, it would have been.
And so once the judge makes that fact finding, the appellate courts are bound to follow it so long as the evidence supports it. Then when it gets into federal court, that's on the state side. Then when the writ gets into federal court, all the federal court says is ask the following question. When the state court decided this writ, is that an unreasonable application of federal law as interpreted by the Constitution? They interpret the facts correctly and the law correctly. And that really isn't a second writ hearing. All it is just simply asking, we may not agree with the state court judge, but if he has a factual basis for making that decision, we're stuck with it. We're going to go with it. So in a real genuine sense, the only person who could have kept him from being executed was the judge that heard the writ. And to have him to be the one who's going to face the electorate, the people who voted for him, is naive to think he's going to go contrary to their wishes. He's not going to do it because the people who would back up Ricky Williams and vote are not going to elect him. The people who put him on death row are going to elect this judge. And although theoretically you have a hearing, it's kind of like years ago when I first moved to Houston, I went out to Bel Air, listened to I've heard about what kind of a hanging court they had in traffic court.
Yeah.
The judge got up and he said, I'm the judge. When I hear a case, I'll set the fine. I thought, I'll hear the case and I'll set your fine. That's what he said.
Why bother about that?
Why bother?
Is that Gloria? Is Gloria ready?
Yes, Gloria. Okay.
And Gloria, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm actually at the hospitality house. Talking to Danielle from France, Ricky's adoptive mother.
Uh-huh. Did you learn anything in that conversation of interest to this program?
I'm not sure. I'm talking to a radio station in Houston that does a program when there's an execution, and I just wondered if you would like to say anything to people who are listening around the world.
I don't speak a good English, but I want to say is in front of barbarism, we are just to talk to each other. I don't want to struggle against Texan people. I want to speak with them. I want only they open their eyes, their hearts. I want everybody together, no more.
That is a wonderful statement, very well put, and accents improve the program, don't hamper it. We wish you, number one, we want to thank you for your loyalty to Ricky.
He was ready.
Ray, it's me again. They're getting ready to go to where the body is.
And I will explain all that to the audience. Thank you so much, Gloria, for your vigilant and hard work.
Okay, all right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Gloria. And Gloria is vigilant, and she is up there. when Gloria is talking about what they're going to do now, they're going to go to a little church that has been rented by the contractor who picks up the body. And he's put the body over there. It's not in a coffin. It's just on a gurney. And the people will be able to touch Ricky for the first time since he was sentenced and sent to death row. He has not touched a human being other than a guard and perhaps another inmate, and maybe even then under hostile circumstances. No one has put their hands on him, and now the family, or what is substitute for the family, his adopted parents, can feel the warmth of his body before he is shipped off to be disposed of. We've got a few minutes here, and I want to do several things with this few minutes. I want to tell you that we are very fortunate to have Jim and Jack and Larry and Susan, our lawyer team, in here tonight. Mr. Gillespie didn't make it, but he'll be here on future shows. And I want you to know that they anguish over these cases. They search very diligently and very hard. A lot of time is put into each of these cases, so they're prepared. Their part of the program is not as opinionated or as obnoxious as my part. Their part is Joe Friday, just the facts. This is what we had. And they're trying to explain a complicated legal system to you in terms that you can grasp in small enough doses that you can see some of the sources of some of the problems of seeking justice. Jim did a very fine job of that, talking about the writ process and what happens when a judge does a finding of fact and a finding of law, how that affects subsequent courts looking at the same situation. We don't know that instinctively because we're not trained to watch for that. These people are. I want to thank Mike, who's sitting here with his fingers on the board trying to keep my volume set so that I don't either blow out your ears or fade into the back. I want to thank the engineering crew of Doyle for doing on that. The next scheduled execution is Ronnie Threadgill. And that is scheduled for April the 16th. We hope for a stay. We always hope for a stay. The producer of the show is Elizabeth Stein. And you can reach her at eliza.tex.usa@qmail.com. Studio engineers tonight are Doyle and Mike Lewis. And Doyle's in there finding us a way out to the universal ether. The real wizard around here that makes the website possible and works and makes sure that we are appropriate, even though we're relegated to HD3, he picks up the signal and puts it on the website, of course, is the inimitable Otis McClay. The theme music that we use on the show is by Victoria Panetti, and she can be reached at She Monster International. And that is to be found at myspace.com/SeaMonster. My name is Ray Hill. I don't like doing these programs, but I do appreciate your listening. This is KPFT HD3 channel. It's executionwatch.com. And you can also hear it on kpftx.org. Thank you for listening, and we will leave you with Victoria on the way out. Good night.